For 1930s English teachers, the proliferation of radio was a humongous cultural shift. Humongous.
Huge.
To get an idea of just how huge a force radio was in the 1930s, let's listen to Max Hertzberg's thoughts in 1935.
The number of hours of time each day when the radio is on in American homes, places of businesses, offices, and school must reach figures of astronomical vastness. Young people, of course, have the habit even more than those of an older generation. The radio, to them, is as commonplace as the weather, and its marvels are as much a matter of course as those of the telephone, or electric lighting, or the photoplay. Many of them have the radio performing constantly during waking, and sometimes working, hours. The beat of a jazz band accompanies, agreeably for them, the study of Julius Caesar, the probing of a geometrical problem, or a translation from Victor Hugo.
I gotta say, if you replace the word radio with the word cell phone in this quote, it sounds strangely contemporary. These kids and their multitasking. They just can't focus on serious books anymore.
I know, right? They literally can't even.
Anyway, so radio was huge for English teachers, not just because it was pervasive, but also because it was powerful. In a 1939 article, Bernice Orndorff explains this power.
We are becoming more and more conscious that radio is a powerful agent of propaganda, more effective even than the printed word. And it is the obligation of teachers to use this instrument for education in the right direction, by teaching pupils to distill the good, the beautiful, the true, from the array offered them.
The good, the beautiful, the true, man, they just don't write them like that anymore.
They just don't. They just don't. I mean, yeah, Orndorff's Platonism seems a little quaint today, but are we really that different? You know, I usually introduce an audio documentary assignment by having students listen to NPR podcasts that I think are more aesthetically pleasing and more robustly fact-checked than the awful propaganda of right-wing talk radio. So in my own way, I'm still using audio to push my own version of the good, the beautiful, and, dare I say it, the true.
You know, Jason, I've always suspected you of being a secret Platonist.
Now.
Okay. So we might still believe in teaching the good, beautiful, and true of NPR radio, but some 1930s claims about radio really do seem anachronistic.
Right? Like the claim that radio could lead to teen violence? I'm thinking especially of that article by Joseph Mersan that opens with the story of a 12-year-old student in Toledo who killed his principal after listening to graphic radio crime dramas.
Oh yeah! Darn those radio crime dramas!
As it went with radio in the 1930s, so it goes with video games today.
Anyway, it's clear to us that 1930s English teachers both feared and were excited by the potential of radio. In a 1937 article, Delight Phillips sums up this ambivalence well when she writes,
"Wait a minute. Her name is Delight?
Yep.
That's great.
It sure is. Well, here's what Delight said.
Radio may be a swift and steady stream, refreshing whosoever drinks from it. Or it may be a brackish pool, dipped into and muddied by every passerby, offering real refreshment to none."
That's delightful.
Stop it. Just stop it.